This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Deadlines have to be realistic, and they cannot be set up in such a way as to be self-defeating. And unfortunately, ECOWAS has violated both of these key principles of diplomacy.
That's Ambassador J. Peter Pham, a former special U.S. envoy for the Sahel, discussing diplomatic missteps on the coup in Niger. Details coming up also. South Africa has busted a crime ring that was smuggling people from Pakistan into the country. And Cameroon struggles to fight rising hunger. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The military coup in Niger, unlike other previous ones in West Africa, has elicited a strong support from younger people living in the country. VOA's Anthony Labruto spoke to Zakaria Kanda, a young Nigerian, on why the military takeover is seen as a unifying and inspiring event for young people across Niger.
When people ask me, are you for the coup or against the coup, I mostly respond I'm 100% supporting the coup. When I say I'm 100% supporting the coup, it doesn't mean like I'm asking for coups to happen in Africa. That's not something we can wish for. But like, I've lived in like red line zone, actually. If you take our country, we have like the western part and the eastern part facing terrorism. And we say for more than 10 years that we're fighting against terrorism. But once you go on the field, you will realize that terrorism is even entertaining by that politicians. It's just like people are saying they're really fighting, but they're not there. The one reason that people are supporting mostly the coup is also when you take the country, generally, how it is, we don't possess our own electricity. The water, we do not have control over it. There's less job opportunities for young people. So like mostly when you see those people like outside, it's young people that are supporting the coup most of the time. It's because they don't see light. They don't see opportunities. And it becomes in our country that corruption is like legal.
What are you hoping that the coup, will change about the future of Niger?
I think if you take the Sahel region, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, we share the same realities. We are like the same people, if I can say, the same people. We're all fighting against terrorism. But like those terrorists are gaining more and more space in our countries just because we're not really fighting on the field. We're just saying we're fighting, but reality is we're just there, nothing. And when they see foreign soldiers in the country, they don't feel secure, and they can't explain that having more than, like, for example, 1,500 soldiers from France not being able to tackle and finish with terrorism in more than 10 years is like we're not really fighting against terrorism.
Do you think that they're going to change the outcomes that's been happening that France or, the European colonial powers couldn't do?
We need to diversify also our partnerships. If French soldiers are not doing the job, then we can also ask for someone who is ready to do the job, to do the job correctly, to come and do the job. And this is the hope. This is really the hope that people have. It's like, okay, once those Russian soldiers arrive, they're going to help us fight against the terrorists and in real, on the field. I don't know if it pays, but like, it's just a try.
The military junta that deposed Niger's president, Mohamed Bazoum, last month said today it may put him on trial for high treason. The statement comes days after West African countries in the ECOWAS group issued a deadline for the coup leaders to reinstate Bazoum, which came and went, and an announcement last week that was readying a standby force for Niger. Ambassador J. Peter Pham, a former special U.S. envoy for the Sahel and a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that all sides need to de-escalate the rhetoric.
it's not helpful that the rhetoric has escalated. You know, a cardinal rule of diplomacy is you never make a threat unless you are prepared to carry it out. Another cardinal rule is deadlines have to be realistic, and they cannot be set up in such a way as to be self-defeating. And unfortunately, ECOWAS has violated both of these key principles of diplomacy. First, the deadline was set way too long, a week, which gave the junta time to entrench itself, deal with, smooth over any dissent within the military ranks, and in fact, win a lot of the population to its side. So they probably shouldn't have set a deadline that far ahead. Then having set the deadline, they should have been more realistic about what they could or could not deliver. And I know there's been the promise at the summit last week that they would raise a standby force, standby. It should have been ready already, but a standby force of 5,000 with no indication of where they were coming from, when they were coming together, and to what end, even if 5,000 were sufficient.
You do sound skeptical. What kind of force would you envision? What would make a difference for this kind of force to actually make a concrete difference?
Well, to be quite frank, if you're going to reverse a coup, it has to occur in what my friend, former Deputy Assistant Secretary for West African Affairs, Todd Moss, called the golden hour. There's a narrow window right after a coup when it might be possible to reverse it. That window has long since closed. It's very, very difficult for an outside force to come in a situation like this, unless there's support within the country for that force. Otherwise, you're talking about an actual invasion. And classic military doctrine says that an invader requires three times the force of the defender if there's even a chance of success. Niger has 25,000 troops, some of whom are very, very well trained by the U.S., France, and others in as special forces for counterterrorism operations. That requires, assuming that all 25,000 were not present, let's just say dealing with just Niamey, let's say a fifth of the Nigerian forces were available, that still would require 15,000, which is not a number ECOWAS is talking about. So they haven't presented a realistic plan or how they're going to go about this. And there's always risk in these types of operations, risks that someone could get hurt, especially prisoners like President Bazoum or some of his ministers. That risk is there when experienced forces like the U.S. Navy SEALs, British SAS, French Special Forces do it. And we're not dealing with that level of professionalism here.
You laid out in your piece last week about some things that can be done. What do you see happening from this point forward?
Well, I think going forward, one has to figure a way to de-escalate. The rhetoric on both sides needs to go down, whether it be charging the former president, deposed president with treason or war across the Sahel. That's not helpful. Let's de-escalate and let's look at reality. And the reality is we have to try to somehow prevent the situation. It's in everyone's interest that the situation in the Sahel does not get worse, that extremist groups do not have an opening to roll back some of the gains. Niger has managed to increase security. Violence this year is at the lowest level since 2018. Certain development goals have been achieved. IDPs, internally displaced persons, are beginning to be resettled. We have to preserve some of those gains.
That's J. Peter Pham, a former special U.S. envoy for the Sahel and a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam in Washington today. You can keep up with the latest news in Niger at voaafrica.com. Police in South Africa have broken a crime syndicate helping Pakistani nationals settle in the region illegally. Security analysts say Sunday's operation raises concerns that members of the international terrorist organizations could have used the syndicate to base themselves in Southern Africa. Darren Taylor reports.
South African law enforcement officials have told VOA they don't know how many Pakistanis and people of other nationalities are now in the country and probably in neighboring countries illegally. Home Affairs Minister Aaron Motsoaledi says his officials began observing very suspicious tendencies involving Pakistani citizens in June last year.
They get transit visas to go to other countries, our neighbors, I mean to say. But somewhere in the airport, they escape and they try to find a route into South Africa by going in through the fire hydrant passages. So we've been watching them. We conducted the sting operation yesterday, the sting operation done by Home Affairs, by the Border Management Authority, State Security and the Hawks, and these 67 were nabbed.
The Hawks is South Africa's top specialized crime-fighting unit. Motsoaledi says it's extremely concerning that the 67 Pakistanis didn't seem to know where they were going to go when they got into South Africa.
I personally sat in rooms when they were interviewing them. Many of them were giving very vague answers, exactly where they are going, who are they visiting. Some will give us names of hotels in which they are going, and the hotel does not exist. Others will give you the name of a person and say, look, I am visiting this person, is my cousin. And then they give us the phone number. When we phone that person, we give them a different name altogether. And he said, yes, yes, that's my cousin. And when we keep on giving different names, we discover that as long as you give a name of a Pakistani national, it becomes a cousin.
Speaking at a news conference late Sunday after the arrests, the minister said crime syndicates are abusing South Africa's new e-visa system, which is supposed to allow easier entry of tourists into the country. Institute for Security Studies analyst Willem Els says some people who've managed to enter South Africa illegally in this way could possibly be members of terror groups.
It seems that the majority of our reactions towards crime is reactive and not proactive, especially when it comes to these type of incidents. We have to commend the police, as we saw that in recent months, there were quite a few intelligence-led operations that led to the arrest of some of these suspects before they could commit the crime, but that is way, way too much in the minority.
Motsoaledi says law enforcement will try to track down others who've entered South Africa illegally using the e-visa process, but he acknowledges it's going to be a very difficult task. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The weak health of Zimbabwe's economy is at the center of the debate in the national elections on August 23rd. Business professor Elliot Masote, professor of business at DeVry University in Ohio, says the ZANU-PF party, which has governed since liberation in 1980, made positive changes early on, but has not been able to boost the economy.
Yes, Zimbabwe's economy has been in bad shape for a very long time. We know the former president was in power for, you know, 40 years. For about 40 years, and some of the policies they introduced, opening up education to everybody, make primary school education compulsory to everybody, it was great. But then they did not actually in factories growing the job market for everybody who was going to be educated, to the point where you are now finding that most of university graduates are getting the streets. So education was expanded, the economy was not. So now they are trying to introduce education 5.0 that helps people coming from universities to be able to form their own jobs right now. And then, the idea of land distribution that happened in the late 90s, that puts Zimbabwe in a very bad shape as a country that was the breadbasket of Southern Africa. And then they took land from commercial white farmers, and some of them left for Nigeria, for Zambia. And those people who were given farms, even the former president, acknowledged that they made a mistake. So the economy was going down and down and down. And again, without any formal planning, Zimbabwe joined the war in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that was the turning point of the Zimbabwean dollar losing value big time. The government was printing money without any backup.
It's funny, you mentioned the white farmers being evicted from their lands. But very recently, Zimbabwe said foreign citizens who had their land seized could now apply to get it back.
I don't think it's going to solve the problem right now. I know there is compensation of those white commercial farmers who lost their land, but that compensation is going to be in monetary forms rather than them getting back their land and then start all over again to kick people out who have already invested a lot in that land they got from the government after the government had taken that land from white commercial farmers. So my understanding is that they have been in negotiations, and the former president of Tanzania, Mr. Joachim Chissano, was at the center of it and agreed that, well, we're going to compensate white commercial farmers in terms of money. I don't know if they're going to get their land back. That is not going to be possible because, you know, the land distribution was included in the constitution to be non-reversible at all. So currently, local commercial farmers, they're beginning to learn how to farm commercially different types of crops, but it should take years for us to get to where we were with the white commercial farmers farming for the country and the whole of Southern Africa, because our local farmers don't have enough equipment, they don't have enough knowledge, skills, and experience to commercially farm and support the country. But they are trying, and the argument of the government was that, you know, those white commercial farmers who lost land, they did not come to Zimbabwe to farm, to Rhodesia to farm, with all the education, skill, and experience. They land it here. So our local black farmers are going to do the same. They got land without education, skills, and experience, and they are in the process of learning exactly the same process as former colonial farmers did. But I think we are getting there where we can feed ourselves as Zimbabweans, but it's going to take time for us to export as we used to do to feed the whole of Southern Africa and beyond.
That was Professor Elliot Masote, professor of business at DeVry University in Ohio. He spoke with me from Harare. We'll have more of that interview in tomorrow's show. Be sure to tune in at voanews.com. Cameroon's government and humanitarian agencies are distributing emergency food to millions of people facing hunger along the country's northern borders with Chad and Nigeria. Authorities blame natural disasters, long-running local conflicts, and Russia's war in Ukraine for causing food shortages. Moki Edwin-Kindeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Aid groups and the government of Cameroon say they distributed rice, millet, and beans to at least 30,000 people this week along the Central African state's northern border with Chad and Nigeria. Refugee populations and host communities are among the recipients. The government and relief agencies now aim to reach a total of 4 million people over the next 6 weeks. Distribution is complicated by torn-up roads and ongoing clashes between government troops and separatist groups in Cameroon's northwest and southwest regions. Aid agencies have also reported sporadic Boko Haram attacks, but the government has said it will protect all aid workers. Ayisi Numa is the coordinator of the emergency food project at the Cameroon Red Cross, one of the agencies distributing food aid. Numa says undernourishment, famine, movements of people out of their communities in search of food in Cameroon's northern border with Chad and Nigeria are the direct consequences of severe floods and attacks by elephants and migratory birds on plantations. Numa says Boko Haram terrorism and clashes between herders and fishers that displaced more than 100,000 people, including farmers, to Chad, are some of the causes of the present food shortages. Numa spoke on Cameroon state broadcaster CRTV on Friday. The separatist crisis in the west and Boko Haram attacks in the north have disrupted food production and left millions of Cameroonians facing hunger in recent years. Russia's invasion of Ukraine made the situation worse. Before Russia's Black Sea blockade, Cameroon imported 60% of its wheat from Ukraine. The cutoff led to a nearly 50% increase in the price of bread. More recently, floods that swept through towns, including the economic hub Douala and Boya and Limbe, both English-speaking Western towns, also rendered several hundred homeless and hungry, the government says. Before Russia's Black Sea blockade, Cameroon imported 60% of its wheat from Ukraine. The cutoff led to a nearly 50% increase in the price of bread. Gabriel Mbarobi is Cameroon's agriculture minister. He says climate shocks added to the present food shortage Cameroon is witnessing.
Agro-pastoral production has been disrupted due to climate hazards, high rainfall in the northern part of the country, sudden cessation of rains in the southern part, which did not allow crops to complete their cycle, crop pests, and destruction of fields by pachyderm and socio-political and inter-community conflicts, affecting 27,000 producers.
Mbarobi says Cameroon's government and its partners are fully engaged to provide emergency food and nutritional supplies to all civilians threatened by hunger and disease. He said, besides distributing food aid, Cameroon is providing hybrid seeds and fertilizers to farmers who agree to return to their farms. The government says it has also distributed drought-tolerant crops to several thousand farmers on Cameroon's northern border with Chad and Nigeria. Meanwhile, Cameroon's livestock ministry reports that several hundred heifers, which quickly adapt to harsh climatic conditions and produce more milk than the local breed of cattle, have been distributed to herders in the area. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Families in Tarhuna, Libya, are calling for justice for relatives they say were killed by partisan militia. Over the past 7 years, hundreds of the town's residents were tortured, killed, and dumped in mass graves about 80 kilometers south of the capital, Tripoli. The militia suspected many of supporting the eastern-based military leader, Khalifa Haftar. The French news agency AFP says the militia, called the Kainiat, seized Tarhuna in 2015 and set about silencing opponents and often their entire families. About 350 dead have been uncovered so far, and the identities of 226 have been established. Families in the area are demanding that the government find the missing and prosecute the killers, including imposing the death penalty. Capital punishment is legal in Libya, but not often applied. In February, a military court sentenced 30 people convicted in the murders to terms of 6 years to life in prison. The Justice Ministry says a second trial of dozens of other suspects in the Tarhuna killings is expected to conclude in the coming weeks. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Peters, and our engineer, Cornelius Tenner, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Climate change, child marriage, girls' education, mental health are some of the issues that African filmmakers are pointing their cameras towards that most impact women on the continent. Next on Our Voices, we'll discuss how women filmmakers in Africa and throughout the diaspora are using this genre of film to shine a light on social, political, and human rights issues. Join the conversations.